told me about the forests of Russia, but I still was amazed. You remember when we drove west in midsummer, I think in 35, and didn't get out of cornfields for 3 days? The North Russian woods are like that. We flew to Moscow at treetop height. Those green branches rushed by below our wings for hours and hours and hours, and then, all at once, we climbed, and ahead of us was a tremendous sprawl from horizon to horizon of houses and factories. Moscow is flat and gray. From a distance, it could be Boston or Philadelphia, but as you get closer in and see the onion-top churches and the dark red Kremlin by the river, with a cluster of churches inside, you realize you're coming to a peculiar place. The pilot flew a circle around Moscow before landing, maybe as a special courtesy, and we got a good look. Incidentally, the takeoffs and landings are expert, but by our standards, hairy. The Russian pilot jumps off the ground and zooms, or he dives in and slams down. Well, since we got to Moscow, we've been in the meat grinder. It's been round the clock. Our orders, literally, are to work through the night. When we aren't conferring, we've been eating and drinking. The standard fare for visitors seems to be a dozen different kinds of cold fish and caviar, then two soups, then fowl, then roasts, with wine going all the time. Each man has his own carafe of vodka. It's a hell of a way to do business, but, on the other hand, the Russians may be wise. The alcohol loosens things up. The feeling of getting drunk is evidently the same for a Bolshevik or a capitalist, so there at least you strike some common ground. I think this conference has been an historic breakthrough. When have Americans and Russians sat down before to talk about military problems, however cagily? It's all most peculiar and new. The Russians don't tell hard facts of their military production or of the battlefield situation. Considering that the Germans, 3 short months ago, were sitting where we and the British sit now, I don't exactly blame them. The Russians have been a hard-luck people. You can't forget that when you talk to them. This is a point that our interpreter, Leslie Sloat, keeps making. I'm not revealing secrets when I tell you the British are yielding some Lend-Lease priorities and even undertaking to send the Russians tanks. It'll all be in the papers. They were stripped bare at Dunkirk, so this is decent and courageous. Of course, they can't use the tanks on the Germans now, and the Russians can. Still, Churchill can't be sure Hitler and Stalin won't make a deal again, so the Germans may suddenly turn and throw everything into a channel crossing. I don't think it'll happen. The growing hate here for the Germans is something savage. You only have to see the gruesome newsreels of villages they've been driven out of to understand why. Children strung up, women raped to death, and all that. Still, Hitler and Stalin seem to have mercury for blood. Nothing they do is too predictable or human, and I give the British lots of points for agreeing to send the Russians tanks. Some of us Americans feel peculiar at this meeting. Damn peculiar. The British, in danger themselves, are willing to help the Russians, while our Congress yells about sending the Russians anything. We sit between men of two countries that are fighting the Germans for their lives, while we represent a land that won't let its president lift a finger to help, not without outcries from coast to coast. Do you remember Sloat? He's the second secretary here now. He looked me up in Berlin, you remember, with a lot of praise for Briney's conduct under fire in Poland. He's the man Natalie went to visit. He still seems to think she's the finest girl alive, and I don't know why he didn't marry her when he had the chance. Right now he's trying to romance Talkie's daughter. Since she's one of the few unattached Western girls, I almost said white girls, in Moscow, Sloat has competition. Incidentally, my remark about white girls is ridiculous. After 2 days in Moscow, trying to put my finger on what was so different here, I said to Sloat there were two things. No advertisements and no colored people. It made him laugh. Still, it's so. Moscow has a real American feel in the informality and equality of the people, but you don't find such a sea of white faces in any big city in America. All in all, I like these Russians and the way they go about their business with determination and calm, the way the Londoners did. Now I have a story for you, and for our grandsons to read one day, especially Byron's boy. It's a grim one, and I'm still not sure what to make of it, but I want to write it down. Yesterday, between the last afternoon conference and the official dinner at the Metropole Hotel, I went to Sloat's apartment for a while with Tudsbury and Pam. Talkie engineered this little party. He wanted to pump me about the conference, but there wasn't much I could disclose. Anyway, I was having a drink with them. If you get this tired, you have to keep up an alcohol level in your bloodstream. It's a sort of emergency gasoline. When a knock came on the door, and in walked a fellow in worn-out boots, a cap, a heavy, shabby coat, and it was a Jewish merchant from Warsaw, Yohanan Jastro, Natalie's uncle, the one they call Beryl. Briny and Natalie went to his son's wedding in South Poland, you recall, and that's how they got caught in the invasion. He's clean-shaven, and speaks Russian and German with ease, and he doesn't seem Jewish, though Sloat remarked that in Warsaw he wore a beard and looked like a rabbi. This fellow's escape from Warsaw with the remnants of his family is a saga. They landed in Minsk and got caught there when the Germans blitzed White Russia. He gave us only bare details of how he got himself and his family out of Minsk through the woods, but obviously this is quite a guy for maneuvering and surviving. Here comes the incredible part. Jastro says that late one night, about a month after the capture of Minsk, the Germans came into the Jewish ghetto they had set up with a caravan of trucks. They cleaned out two of the most heavily populated streets, jamming everybody into these trucks. Men, women, children, babies, old folks who couldn't walk. Several thousand people, at least. They drove them to a ravine in the forest a few miles out of town, and there they shot them, every single one, and buried them in a huge, freshly dug ditch. Jastro says the Germans had rounded up a gang of Russians earlier to dig the ditch and then had trucked them out of the area. A few of them sneaked back through the woods to see what would happen, and that was how the story got out. One of them had a camera and took pictures. Jastro produced three prints. This occurrence, whatever it was, took place at dawn. In one of them you see a line of gun flashes. In another you see this distant, shadowy crowd of people. In the third, which is the brightest, you just see men in German helmets shoveling. Jastro also gave Sloat two documents in Russian, one handwritten and one typed, that purported to be eyewitness accounts. Jastro says he decided to get to Moscow and give some American diplomat the story of the massacre in Minsk. I don't know how he got Sloat's address. He's a resourceful man, but naive. He believed, and evidently still believes, that once President Roosevelt found out this story and told the American people, the United States would immediately declare war on Germany. Jastro turned over these materials to Sloat and said he'd risked his life to get that stuff to Moscow, and that a lot of women and children had been murdered. So would he please guard those pictures and documents with care? He and I talked a bit about the kids. His eyes filled up when I told him Byron and Natalie had a boy. After he left, Sloat offered the stuff to Tudsbury. He said, "There's your broadcast for you. You'll hit all the front pages in the United States." To our surprise, Tudsbury said he wouldn't touch the story. He worked in British propaganda after he was wounded in the last war and helped concoct and plant atrocity yarns. He claims the British invented the business of the Germans making soap out of the bodies of soldiers. Maybe this Minsk massacre happened but to him, Jastrow looked like an NKVD plant. It was too coincidental that a distant Polish relative of mine, by marriage, a freakish connection to begin with, should suddenly pop up of his own free will in Moscow with this yarn and these documents. A heated argument ensued, and Tudsbury finally said that even if he knew the story were true, he wouldn't use it. This thing could backfire and keep America out of the war, he claimed, just as Hitler's Jewish policy worked for years to paralyze the British. Nobody wants to fight a war to save the Jews, he kept insisting, while banging the table. And Hitler still has a lot of people convinced that anyone who fights Germany is really spilling blood just for the Jews. Talkie says this is one of the great war propaganda ideas of all time, and that this story about the Minsk Jews would play into German hands. Well, I've just set down the bald facts of this. I didn't mean to get so long-winded, but it's been haunting me. If there's even an element of truth in Jastrow's yarn, then the Germans really have run amok, and among other things, Natalie and her infant, unless they're out of Italy by now, are in grave hazard. Mussolini apes whatever Hitler does, but I assume they did get out. Sloat tells me it was all set before her confinement. Rhoda, when I think about Jastrow's story, my head spins, and it seems to me the world I grew up in is dissolving. Even if it's an exaggeration, just hearing such a story makes me think we're entering some new dark age. It's all too much for me. And the worst of it is, I found it hard not to believe Jastrow. The man has a keen and dignified manner, not a man I mind having for a relative, strange as it felt to look on him as such. It's 6:05. I have to wrap this up and get on to the banquet. This war has sure played hell with our family, hasn't it? The days in Manila, with all 3 kids in school and that house with a tennis court where I taught them all to play, seem a far-off dream. Those were the best days. And now, here I am in Moscow. I hope you're keeping up that weekly doubles game with Fred Kirby and the Vances. You always feel better when you get exercise. Give my best to Blinker and Anne, also to Fred, and tell him I hope Foggy Bottom isn't getting him down. I miss you, busy as I am, but you sure wouldn't care for Soviet Russia, darling, in war or peace. Pamela Tudsbury says there isn't a hairdresser in Moscow she'd go to. She cleans her own suits and dresses with gasoline. You know, I've now met Hitler, Churchill, Roosevelt, and tonight I may shake hands with Stalin. Considering that I'm nobody much, that's something. My career's taken a decidedly freakish turn. For my grandson's information, you already know this, I'd have preferred an entry in my record showing I'd been at sea these past 2 years. But there's no changing that, and in a way I guess it's been an education. Only at this point, I've had my belly full, and so help me God, I would gladly trade dinner in the Kremlin for one honest-to-God whiff of Navy stack gas. Till the next time, with lots of love, Pug. Victor Henry had arrived with the Harriman-Beaverbrook mission just as the Germans were starting their autumn smash toward Moscow. The panzer armies were breaking through less than 100 miles away, but the Russians wined and dined their visitors, whirled them about the city in black limousines, took them to the ballet, and carried on long committee meetings, with no hint that anything was going wrong, though they did appear a bit brisk in laying on a farewell banquet less than a week after the guests had got there. The Americans and the British understood that the Germans had been stopped east of Smolensk more than a month earlier in their central push, and had been pinned down there on the defensive ever since. In Moscow, this halting of the Nazi hordes in the center was still talked of as a great feat of Soviet arms, a new miracle of the Marne. Just as the French had stopped the Huns 30 miles from Paris in 1914, and snatched away their chance of quickly winning the war, So the Red Army had halted Hitler's marauders, the assertion went, in their drive to seize Moscow before the winter set in. The Russians had even taken foreign correspondents to this central front, showing them recaptured villages, smashed Nazi tanks, and dead and captured Germans. Now the Germans claimed the march toward Moscow was rolling again, and the Russians were denying it. The fog of war effectively hid what was really happening. Contrary to a notion popular at the time, a notion which has never quite died, the Wehrmacht was not a giant solid phalanx of tanks and armored cars, spitting flame and death as it clanked through whole nations. Hitler had a horse-drawn army. It was larger than Napoleon's, but mainly it advanced into Russia, as the Grande Armée had, by animal power and the march of men's feet. He also had some armored divisions, spaced on the flanks of the three big groups invading the Soviet Union. The Blitzkrieg worked so. The armored forces, the panzers, chugged ahead on either side of each attack front, slicing into enemy lines, counting on surprise, terror, and punch to soften or panic the foe. The infantry came along between these two swaths as fast as it could, killing or capturing the forces which the panzer divisions had broken into or thinly encircled. These armored divisions were a big success, and no doubt Hitler would have been glad to employ more of them. But he had started his war, as generals had feebly grumbled, much too soon, only 6 years after he took power. He had not come near arming Germany to the full, though he had made frightening noises exactly as if he had, and Europe had believed him. He was, therefore, very low on panzer divisions, considering the vastness of the front. In August, when his three-pronged attack had jabbed far into the Soviet Union, Hitler diverted the thin armored layers of the central formation, north and south, to help wrap up the war on the flanks by taking Kiev and investing Leningrad. This done, the panzers were to come back on station and start driving again with the center group for the knockout blow on the capital. It was a move that military writers still argue about. But in any case, with the central armor thus peeled away, the infantry and horse-drawn artillery in the center, perforce, had to halt and dig in, to await the return of the panzers, the steel-cutting edges, from their side excursions. This was the new miracle of the Marne. The Russians were at first surprised, then immensely heartened at this sudden stop of the huge force advancing on their capital, and disorganized though they went over to counterattacks and won minor gains. The miracle ceased at the end of September, when the panzer armies, back in their positions, and properly overhauled and gassed up, went slashing toward Moscow again, in two wide curving paths. That was when Harriman and Beaverbrook arrived, with the obscure Captain Henry in their train. Chapter 52. The knot of Leslie Sloat's tie came lopsided twice in his shaky, hurrying hands. He flung the tie in a corner, pulled another from his dresser, and managed a passable knot. He put on his jacket and sat in a heavy brown leather armchair to calm himself with a cigarette, flinging long legs on the ottoman. A German correspondent had abandoned this apartment on June 15th, making a hasty deal with him. For Moscow, these were splendid digs. Three rooms, a kitchen, a bathroom, solid German furniture. Pamela Tudsbury liked the place and had cooked many a dinner here for Sloat and some of their friends. The English-speaking embassy people and correspondents, an isolated, gossipy little band, assumed that the British girl and the American Foreign Service officer were having an affair. So did Sloat's thick-set Russian maid, Valya, who beamed on them and tiptoed about when Pamela was visiting. Sloat yearned for such an affair. He had not gotten over the marriage of Natalie Jastrow, and nothing closed such an ego wound like a new romance. But Pam Tudsbury, whom he remembered from Paris as the warm-blooded girlfriend of Philip Rule, wild in her ways, candidly sensual, freshest and gayest when the dawn came up, brushed off his passes. She was in a gloomy state. She was being true, she said, to her fiancé, a missing RAF pilot. Pam's skin was fair as in the Paris days, her heart-shaped face, with its thin bow of a mouth, still a flower of English prettiness. She wore tailored wool suits, flat shoes, and glasses, but inside that secretarial uniform glowed the girl who had whipped off her stockings and splashed barefoot in the fountain on a midsummer night with Phil Rule, holding her red silk dress at mid-thigh. She still owned that dress, and sometimes wore it. Sloat had patiently been taking Pamela's company on her terms, biding his chances to improve them. But the arrival of Captain Victor Henry deprived him of Pamela on any terms. When he glimpsed Pam with Henry, Sloat knew at once he was looking at a woman in love. So much for fidelity to the missing airman. As for Captain Henry, this stumpy, sallow, tired-looking fellow of 50 or so seemed to the Foreign Service officer almost a caricature of the anonymous military man. Short on small talk, quick on professional matters, poker-faced, firm, and colorless. One couldn't even tell whether Henry liked Pamela Tudsbury. He made no visible return of her unguarded, deep glances. Sloat failed to fathom the attraction this middle-aged dullard held for the young Englishwoman, and he had never understood Natalie Jastrow's infatuation with the man's son, either. Fate had served him a strange, indigestible dish, Leslie Sloat thought, to be beaten out first by the son and then by the father. Neither of them, in his own judgment, a worthy rival. Byron Henry, at least, was a handsome young devil, and had much changed Sloat's ideas of the susceptibility of clever women to surface charms. But there was nothing charming on the surface of Byron's father. The best one could say for the man was that he still had his hair, thick and dark, and that his waist showed an effort to stay trim. But his age was evident in the weary, wrinkled eyes, the gnarled hands, the seamed mouth, the deliberate movements. Sloat was about to meet Admiral Stanley and Captain Henry at the Hotel National. He was going to interpret for them at the Kremlin banquet. This privilege did not, in prospect, make him happy. He was in a state of panicky foreboding. During the first weeks of the invasion, Sloat's physical cowardice, which he lived with as other people live with hay fever or high blood pressure, had not acted up. Sloat was an admirer of Soviet Russia. He believed the news on the loudspeakers and argued that the German victory claims were propaganda. 600 miles, more than 100 million Russians, and above all the Great Red Army, lay between him and the Germans. It was too far even for the Luftwaffe to fly. The barometer of his timidity read the Moscow climate as sunny and fair. The Muscovites, a peaceable, good-natured, rather shabby swarm of working men in caps, working women in shawls, boys and girls in scarlet, young communist neckerchiefs, all with flat, calm Russian faces, so much alike that they appeared to be one family of several million first cousins, placidly piled sandbags, taped windows, held anti-incendiary drills for air raids that didn't come, and otherwise went about their business as before, under blue skies in warm, sparkling weather. Silver barrage balloons bobbed at their winches in open squares. Snouts of anti-aircraft guns appeared on the roofs of hotels and museums. Strapping, red-cheeked young men wearing new uniforms and fine leather boots streamed to the railroad stations. Tanks, multi-wheeled trucks, and motor-driven big guns thumped and clanked along the boulevards day and night, all heading west. The theaters and cinemas stayed open. The ice cream of the street vendors was as rich as ever. The summer circus was playing to great crowds, for this year there was a dancing elephant, as well as the bears. If one could trust one's eyes and ears in Moscow, the Soviet Union had met the onslaught at its distant borders and dealt the Nazis their first big defeat, exactly as Radio Moscow claimed. Then Minsk fell, then Smolensk, then Kiev, each Russian acknowledgment lagging a week or more behind the German crows of victory. Air raids started. The Luftwaffe had come into range. Nobody else inside the embassy became as alarmed as Sloat, because nobody else had counted much on the Russians. Moreover, nobody else had undergone the ordeal of Warsaw. Since May, the ambassador had been storing food, fuel, and supplies in a large house 30 miles from the city, to sit out the coming siege. A few of the Americans, rubbed raw by the Russians' difficult ways, even looked forward to seeing the Wehrmacht march into Red Square. At least, after a few drinks, they said so. Sloat had stopped arguing, having been proved so wrong about the Red Army, but he thought the complacency and indifference of the other Americans was almost insane. The air raids were getting worse as the Germans drew nearer. Moscow's amazingly thick anti-aircraft barrage provided a comforting canopy of green, red, and yellow fireworks mounting past searchlight beams in the black night. Yet, bombs did fall. The terror of the siege guns was still to come. Even if he survived the siege, thought Sloat, how safe would he be? By then, Roosevelt's blatant help to Nazism's enemies might have provoked a triumphant Hitler to declare war. If Moscow fell, the Americans might all be taken to Ravine and shot like the Jews in Minsk. Then Adolf Hitler could apologize for the mistake, or deny that it had happened, or say the Russians had done it. Beryl Jastrow's story filled Sloat with horror. He had read the books about Germany on the list he had given Byron Henry, and many more. The Germans, in their naive passion for obedience, their streaks of coarseness and brutality, their energy, their intelligence, their obsessive self-centeredness, their eternal grievance that the world was against them and doing them injustice, their romantic yearnings for new extremes of experience— this last trait bubbling up ad nauseam in the romantic philosophers, and nailed down by Goethe once and for all in the Faust image. These 80 million strangers in Europe seemed, to Leslie Sloat, capable, once they abandoned their strict and docile conventions, of slaughtering any number of innocent people upon orders, cheerfully and with no sense of guilt, not in the least aware that they were committing atrocities. There was no striking bottom in the German spirit. That was the strange and fearful thing about them. They were like remote cold children, as docile and as cruel. Hitler's dread secret was that he understood them. Other nations at war could be counted on to observe such rules as exchanging besieged or captured diplomats. In Sloat's frightened view, such diplomats could perhaps count on Hitler's Germans not to eat them, little more. The red light of the setting sun was fading outside his window. It was time to go and accompany Victor Henry to a night of sitting in the bullseye of the Moscow air target. Not surprisingly, he found Captain Henry in Tudsbury's suite. Despite the chill in the room, the naval officer lolled on a couch in his shirt sleeves, smoking a cigar. Pamela was sewing at a crumpled blue coat with gold stripes in the light of a red-shaped lamp atop an alabaster Venus. "Hi there," Henry said. Pamela said, "Loose brass buttons. We don't want them bouncing all over the Kremlin parquet floor. Have some scotch and tap water, Leslie. Beaverbrook gave the governor a bottle." Glancing at his wristwatch, Sloat sat himself on the edge of a chair. "No, thanks. I hope you haven't had much, Captain. When you start on a Russian dinner, the last thing you want in your system is alcohol. Henry grunted.
You're telling me. I haven't touched it.
Pamela sewed, Victor Henry smoked, and the foreign serviceman felt he was very superfluous in the room. He looked at his watch once, twice, and coughed. I said I'd meet the Admiral in the lobby at 6. It's 10 of. Suppose I look for him now. You'll join us, Captain?
Sure, Henry said.
You seem so calm, Leslie, Pam said. If I were actually going into the Kremlin, I'd be vibrating.
Captain Henry seems pretty calm, Sloat said.
Oh, him, Pamela said. He's a robot, a mechanical man. Chug, chug, chump, chump, clink.
I need new batteries, Henry said, and possibly a valve job.
The intimate teasing made Sloat feel even more superfluous. Well, in 10 minutes, then, he said. Pamela said,
Just 2 more buttons. Damn, that's twice I've pricked my finger. I never could sew.
Clumsy black limousines clustered before the hotel, a rare sight. Since the start of the war, the sparse auto traffic on Moscow's wide boulevards and squares had been dwindling to nothing. Muscovites, taking evening strolls in their usual large numbers, glanced inquisitively at the machines, but did not stop to gawk. Chauffeurs and escorts in black caps and black leather jackets stood by the cars. The Americans called them the YMCA boys. They were secret police, and the people seemed loath to linger near them. But as the cars began to fill with well-dressed foreigners thronging out of the National's narrow entrance, the pedestrians did form lines of quiet onlookers, peering with round friendly eyes at the clothes, faces, and shoes.
"How did you make out on those harbor charts?"
said Admiral Standley to Henry, settling into the back seat and adjusting his hearing aid. He had once been chief of naval operations, and the president had called him out of retirement for this mission. Sloat could never make this shriveled, leathery, bespectacled man, whose uniform displayed 4 rows of campaign ribbons, stop talking near NKVD agents, who undoubtedly knew English, though they never spoke it.
"I got nowhere," Henry said. "As for operating codes and signals, forget it. Their fellow told me with a straight face that they had no such things, that they just communicated by Morse or flashing light in plain language."
"What tripe! Did you give them our stuff?"
"Well, I showed them our general signal book and a few strip ciphers. I almost got into a wrestling match with this rear admiral, the small fat one. He started to put them away in his briefcase, but I retrieved them. I said, 'No ticky, no shirty.'"
"No, did you really?" said the admiral. "Why, you may hang for that, pug. We're supposed to give, give, give here. Why, you should just have handed over all our Navy's code channels and shaken hands and toasted eternal brotherhood in vodka. I'm ashamed of you, Captain Henry, and goddamn glad you're along."
"We're getting a quid pro quo for all we're giving the Soviets," Sloat said. "They're killing Germans for us."
"They're killing Germans so as not to get killed by Germans," said the admiral. "They're not doing it for us."
Pug said to Sloat, "Look here, Leslie. If we're going to plan for convoys to Murmansk and Archangel, and for possible joint operations, we've got to swap hydrographic dope and operational codes. Hell, we're not asking for secret combat channels. This is the stuff we need for seamanship and piloting."
"Russians are obsessed with secrecy," Sloat said. "Be persistent and patient."
The cars, having made a wide circuit of streets around the Kremlin, were stopping at a tall gateway under a red stone tower topped by a star.
"That won't help," said the admiral. "I think these birds just haven't gotten the green light from Mr. Big. And until they do, no dice.
At this stream of slang, the NKVD escort turned and squinted narrow Tartar eyes at the admiral, before saying to Sloat, in Russian, with a polite smile, that they would stay in the car on passing through the gate. The limousines, checked one at a time by big, fierce-looking gun-bearing sentries in faultless uniform, drove into the citadel, stopped at an inner gate for another check, then passed among bizarre old churches to a long building with a majestic stone facade. The visitors, with Russian officers mingling among them, left the cars, mounted the steps, and stood talking outside the great closed doors, their breaths smoking in the chilly air. A light blue sky, puffy with pink sunset clouds, arched from wall to wall of the fortress. Suddenly the palace doors opened, and the foreigners were blinking at dazzling light from globed chandeliers in a very long, high-ceilinged hall, ending in a cascade of vermilion carpet on a far-off white marble staircase. As they walked in, warm air enveloped them, a novelty in Moscow, where all building heat had been forbidden until mid-October. Inside, a musty smell of old stone walls and old furnishings was mixed with an almost flowery odor. White-gloved attendants in military livery helped the visitors off with their coats and hats. Along the mirrored walls, on dark tables, dozens of combs and brushes were neatly laid out.
"Thoughtful touch, this," Victor Henry said to Sloat, as they stood side by side, brushing their hair. "Say, what did the ambassador think of that stuff from Minsk? Did you get it to him?"
Sloat nodded at Pug's mirror image. "I wanted it to go to Secretary Hull. High priority?" "The ambassador quashed that. The stuff's to be forwarded through channels to our East European desk."
Pug wrinkled his nose. "That'll be the end of it. Your department always drags its feet on the Jews. Better show the papers to some American newspaper man here."
"The boss directly ordered me not to, in case it's evaluated as fake atrocity propaganda." Young army officers, handsome, clear-eyed giants in brown uniforms with scarlet collar tabs, appeared through side doors and began shepherding the visitors toward the staircase. Walking beside Sloat, Pug said,
"Suppose you have Fred Fearing up for a drink, and he accidentally, on purpose, reads the material. A reporter will steal a scoop from his old blind grandmother, you know."
"Are you suggesting that I disobey orders?"
"I don't think that story should get buried."
The admiral came and hooked elbows with them on the staircase, cackling,
"Say, how's this for socialist austerity? Can't you just see ghosts of Tsarist nobles and their beautiful ladies on this red carpet? This is right out of the movies."
The company passed through a bleak, modernist room full of desks with microphones, and the army officers explained that here the Supreme Soviet met. They straggled through one vast room after another, apparently unaltered since Tsarist days, richly furnished in French or Italian or English styles, crammed with paintings and statuary, with no visible purpose except to overawe. The effect, mounted of wasteful magnificence, displayed helter-skelter with a heavy hand. In one room, grander and richer than the rest, pillared in marble, with a vaulted gilt ceiling and red damask-covered walls, the company of about 80 men halted. The chamber seemed not at all crowded by them. Mirrored doors opened, and a party of Russian civilians came in, wearing unpressed, flopping trousers and ill-fitting double-breasted jackets. Sloat at once recognized several faces that lined Lenin's tomb at the May Day parades: Molotov, Kaganovich, Soslov, Mikoyan.
"Look at those guys, come on, will you?" Victor Henry said. "They make you feel like the revolution happened last week."
Sloat gave him a quick glance. the apparition of these inelegant communist bosses in the gorgeous Grand Palace had jarred him, too, and the Navy man had crystallized this feeling in one sentence. Henry was sizing up the approaching communists through half-closed eyes, as though he were peering at a horizon.
"That's the Politburo, Captain," Sloat said. "Very big cheeses."
Henry nodded. "They don't look like big cheeses, do they?"
"Well, it's those terrible clothes," Sloat said.
Introductions began. Liveried waiters passed with trays of vodka in little tulip-shaped glasses and plates of pastry sticks. Sloat ate a stick for research purposes. It was far too sugary. A little man walked alone in the room, smoking a cigarette. No ceremony was made of it. Nobody stopped conversing, but the Grand State Chamber and all the people in it polarized toward this man, for he was Stalin. It was a matter of side glances, of shoulders and faces turned, of small moves in the crowd, of a rounding of eyes. So Leslie Sloat saw, for the first time, in the flesh, the man whose busts, photographs, statues, and paintings filled the Soviet Union like images of Christ in a Catholic land. The communist dictator, a surprisingly short man with a small paunch, moved through the room, shaking hands and chatting. The subtle focus traveled with him like a spotlight. He came to the two American naval officers, put out his hand to the admiral, and said,
"Stalin."
He looked like his pictures, except that his pallid skin was very coarse and pitted, as though he had once had bad acne. His slanted eyes, thick, back-swept, grizzled hair, and arching mustache and eyebrows gave him a genial, leonine look. Unlike the other communists, he wore a uniform of simple beige cloth superbly tailored, with sharply creased trousers tucked into soft, gleaming brown boots. Leslie Sloat made introductions. Captain Henry said in slow Russian, with a bad American accent,
"Sir, I will tell this story to my grandchildren."
Raising a thick eyebrow, Stalin said in a low, pleasant voice,
"Yes, do you have any?"
"Two boys."
"And your children, do you have sons?"
The dictator appeared diverted by Victor Henry's slow, carefully drilled, mechanical speech.
"I have two, Mr. Chairman. My older son flies for the Navy. My younger one is in a submarine."
Stalin looked at Victor Henry through cigarette smoke with vague interest. Pug said,
"Forgive my poor Russian. I had Russian playmates once, but that was long ago."
"Where did you have Russian playmates?"
"I was born near the Russian River in California. Some of those early families still remain there."
Stalin smiled a real smile, showing tobacco-stained teeth.
Yes. Fort Ross. Not many people know that we Russians settled California before you did. Maybe it's time we claimed California back."
"They say your policy is to fight on one front at a time, Comrade Chairman."
With a smiling grunt, Stalin said,
"Ha, ha, очень хорошо, very good,"
struck Henry lightly on his shoulder, and walked on.
"Now what the hell was all that about California, Pug?"
The admiral had been listening with a baffled look.
"By thunder, you've really picked up that lingo."
Victor Henry recounted the chat, and the admiral laughed out loud.
"By God! Write down every word of that, Pug. You hear? I intend to put it in my report. One fighting front at a time. Well done."
"I must compliment you," Sloat said. "You spoke with presence of mind, and he enjoyed it."
"He puts you at your ease," Pug said. "I knew I was murdering the grammar, but he never let on. Did you see his hands? Beautifully manicured."
"Say, I didn't notice that," said the admiral. "How about that, Sloat? Lots of us decadent capitalists don't bother with manicures, But the head red does. Makes you stop and think, hey?
Sloat hadn't noticed the manicure and was vexed at having missed the detail. Soon the large company was moving again, this time into a stupendous banquet hall of white marble, red tapestries, and shiny parquet, where silver, gold, and glass glittered on the white cloths of many tables set amid green stone columns. One table, on a dais, stretched the length of the room, perhaps 100 feet. The others stood perpendicular to the dais. Light flooded from the myriad frosted globes of 2 gigantic Baroque gilt chandeliers hanging from a high ceiling of vermilion and gold. More light blazed on the walls, in ornate gold sconces.
"Wow," Pug said.
Leslie Sloat stared around at the walls and ceiling.
"It's the Catherine the Great room. I've seen it in paintings. There's her crest, in those big medallions. She got some French or Italian architect in to gut this part of the palace, I believe, and do it over. It was her throne room."
"Well, if this is their style of living, by God," said the Admiral, "they'll make a communist of me yet."
"I wouldn't be too surprised," Sloat replied, "if this is the first time the room has been used since the Revolution." The menu, printed in Russian and English on thick, creamy paper with a hammer and sickle gold crest, listed fish, soups, game, fowls, and roast meats, down the entire long page. Attendants began to bring the courses, while more attendants stood around with bottles of wine and vodka, springing to pour. The splendid great room, the massive array of brilliantly set tables, the multicolored uniforms of generals and admirals of 3 countries, the line of powerful men on the dais, with Stalin at a sharp focus even here, chatting left and right with Beaverbrook and Harriman, the lavish service, the river of wine, the gobs of caviar, the parade of rich, fat foods on czarist gold plate, all this overwhelmed Victor Henry with a reassuring sense of Russian resources, Russian strength, Russian largesse, Russian hospitality, and Russian self-confidence. Sloat had a different reaction. No doubt the communist leaders were enjoying themselves and being hospitable, but in this vulgar outpouring, this choke of luxury, he sensed a note of crude Slav irony. Silent, unspoken, yet almost thunderous, was this message. "Very well, you of the West. These are the things that seem to make you happy. Opulence and pleasure sweated out of others. See how well we do it too, if we choose? See how our old Russian regime did it before we kicked them out. Can you match them? Tomorrow we'll go back to the simple life we prefer, but since you come from the decadent West, fine, let's all get drunk together and gorge and swill. We Russians know how to live as well as you do, and for the fun of it, we'll even go you one better tonight. Let's see who slides under the table first. Vashe zdrovye. Vashe zdrovye." Toasts kept flaring up. Anybody apparently had the license to stand, hammer at a glass with his knife for attention, and bawl a toast. Men would leave their seats and cross the room to clink glasses when a toast complimented or pleased them. Stalin kept trotting here and there, glass in hand. It was all marvelously interesting to Sloat, but it was rushing by too fast, and he was missing too much. Interpreting between the American admiral and the short, fat Russian admiral who had tried to keep the Navy codes. Sweat shining on his bright red face, the old Russian kept groaning, as he tossed down vodka and wine, that he was a very sick man, had not much time to live, and might as well enjoy himself. The American admiral said at one point,
"What the hell, Sloat? Tell him he looks a lot better than I do. He looks fine."
"Ah, but you see, tell him I am like the capitalistic system," groaned the little admiral.
Healthy on the outside, rotten inside.
Sloat enjoyed translating this remark, but most of the Admiral's talk was vague maundering about their families. He envied Victor Henry, quietly observing the scene and using all the tricks not to drink much. Sloat's ears began to hurt from the shouting of the two admirals over the rising noise of the feast. He was trying to eat a succulent roast quail in sour cream, served with a fine cold Crimean white wine, but the sharpening exchange kept him too busy. Why, the Russian insisted, why wouldn't the mighty American Navy at least convoy lend-lease goods to England? Were they afraid of the few tin-plated U-boats? It was idiotic. His slamming fist made glasses jump. Idiotic! To manufacture war goods and ship them out just as target practice for Hitler's torpedoes.
"Tell him we'll be convoying any day," snapped the American. "But unless he loosens up with some harbor data and operation signals, hell will freeze over before we convoy to Murmansk."
The old Russian glared at the old American as Sloat translated. Both officers gulped glasses of vodka and stopped talking. This respite allowed Sloat to look around at the banquet, which was becoming very convivial indeed, with several heads down on tables and one bald Russian general staggering out, held up at the elbows by two attendants. The cessation of the shouts in his ears enabled him to hear another noise, muffled, harsh thumps in an irregular pattern.
Brum, brum, brum.
His stomach suddenly felt cold. His eyes met Victor Henry's.
"Gunfire,"
he started to say, but the words stuck in his throat. He coughed.
"Gunfire? Air raid?"
Henry nodded. "I'll bet they have the heaviest AA in the world right on these grounds. Listen to that. Through all those thick walls. Unreconstructed hell's breaking loose."
"The Germans would do very well," Sloat said with a little laugh, "if they scored a bomb hit here tonight."
The thump of the guns came louder and thicker, and some banqueters were glancing uneasily at the walls. The old Russian admiral, slumped in his seat, scarlet face resting on his chest, was shooting ill-natured glances at the Americans. Now he pushed himself to his feet, clinked furiously at a water glass until he got some attention, then held up a brimming glass of yellow vodka.
"If you please, I am sitting with representatives of the United States Navy, the most powerful navy in the world. These brave men must be very unhappy that while all humanity is in mortal danger, their ships ride at anchor, gathering barnacles."
He turned to the American admiral with a sarcastic grin.
"So I drink to the day when this strong navy will get in the scrap and help destroy the Hitlerite rats, the common enemy of mankind."
The toast left a silence. Sloat translated it in a low, rapid mutter. Military and civilian Russians at nearby tables shook their heads and exchanged troubled looks. The old man dropped heavily in his seat, glaring around with self-satisfaction. The American admiral's voice shook as he said to Sloat,
"If I reply, you'll have an international incident on your hands."
Victor Henry said at once,
"Admiral, shall I give it a try with my lousy Russian?"
"It's all yours, Pug."
Leslie Sloat reached to touch Henry's arm. "See here, the other Russians didn't like what he said either. Just a drop of vodka too much."
"Okay."
Victor Henry rose, glass in hand. The subdued talk in the room faded down. The whumping of the anti-aircraft guns sounded louder, and glasses vibrated and tinkled with the concussions. The men at the head table, including Stalin, fastened intent eyes on the American. Henry brought out his response in slow, stumbling, painful phrases, in bad grammar.
my chief tells me to respond for the United States Navy. It is true we are not fighting. I drink first to the wise peace policy of Marshal Stalin, who did not lead your country into the Great War before you were attacked, and so gained time to prepare. Sloat was startled by the barbed aptness of the retort. The wise peace policy of Comrade Stalin was the communist cliché for Stalin's deal with Hitler. Henry went on, with groping pauses for words that left tense silence in the vast hall.
That is the policy of our president. If we are attacked, we will fight. I hope as well as your people are fighting. Now, as for...
He stopped to ask Sloat for the Russian word. Barnacles. Any barnacles that get on our ships nowadays are barnacles that can swim very fast. Our ships are on the move. We don't announce everything we do. Secrecy is another wise policy of both our countries. But let's not keep so many secrets from each other that we can't work together. Now, our Navy needs some... Again, Henry asked Sloat for a word. Some harbor data, weather codes, and so forth from you. We need them before we leave. Since this is a farewell banquet, I also drink to some fast action. Finally, I was a naval attaché in Berlin. I have now traveled from Hitler's chancellery to the inside of the Kremlin. That is something Hitler will never do, and above all, I drink to that. There was loud applause, a general raising of glasses, and shouts of, "Your health! Fast action!" Sloat reached up to stop Pug from drinking, and pointed. Joseph Stalin, glass in hand, was leaving his seat.
"Holy smoke, what's the etiquette on this?" Henry said.
"I don't know," Sloat said. "Don't drink yet. By God, Captain Henry, that was rising to an occasion." Pug strode toward Stalin, with Sloat hurrying behind him. The dictator said with an amiable grin, as they met near the dais and clinked glasses amid smiles and hand-clapping,
"I thank you for that fine toast, and in response, you can keep California."
"Thank you, Mr. Chairman," Pug said, and they both drank.
"That's a good start. And can you do anything else for us?"
"Certainly. Fast action," said Stalin, linking his arm in Pug's.
They were so close that Pug caught an odor of fish on Stalin's breath.
"American style. We Russians can sometimes do it, too."
He walked toward the two admirals, and the old red-faced Russian stumbled to his feet and stood very erect. Stalin spoke to him in low, rapid sentences. Sloat, behind Victor Henry, caught only a few words, but the pop-eyed look of the admiral and Stalin's tones were self-translating. The dictator turned to Victor Henry, beaming again.
"Well, it is arranged about the weather codes and so forth. Tell your chief that we Russians do not intentionally embarrass our guests. Tell him I feel the American Navy will do historic things in this struggle and will rule the ocean when peace comes."
As Sloat quickly translated, Admiral Stanley stood, his thin, withered lips quivering, and grasped the dictator's hand. Stalin went back to the head table. The incident seemed to stay in his mind, because when he rose to make the last toast of the evening to President Roosevelt, he returned to the theme. The interpreter was Omansky, the ambassador to the United States, whose well-cut blue suit marked him off from the other Russians. His English was extremely smooth.
"Comrade Stalin says President Roosevelt has the very difficult task of leading a country which is non-belligerent, yet wants to do all it can to help the two great democracies of Europe in their fight against fascism. Comrade Stalin says..."
Umansky paused and looked all around the wide room, in a silence no longer marred by gunfire. May God help him in his most difficult task. This religious phrase brought a surprised stillness, then a surge of all the banqueters, glasses in hands, to their feet, cheering, drinking, and applauding. Harriman heartily shook Stalin's hand. The plethoric little Russian admiral grasped the hands of Sloat, Henry, and Stanley. And all over the room the banquet dissolved in great handshaking, back-slapping, and embracing. But the evening was not over. The Russians marched their guests through more empty, splendid rooms to a movie theater, with about 50 soft, low armchairs, each with a small table where attendants served cakes, fruits, sweets, and champagne. Here they showed a war movie and then a long musical, and Sloat did something he would never have believed possible. In the heart of the Kremlin, he fell asleep. A swelling of finale music woke him seconds before the lights came on. He saw others starting awake in the glare, furtively rubbing their eyes. Stalin walked out springily with Beaverbrook and Harriman, both of whom had red eyes and suffering expressions. In a grand hall, under a vast painting of a battle in snow, he shook hands with all the guests, one by one. Outside the grand palace, the night was black, without stars, and the wind was cold and biting. The NKVD agents, leather collars turned up to their ears, blue flashlights in hand, looked sleepy, chilled, and bored, sorting the guests into their limousines.
"Say, how the devil can he drive so fast in this blackout?" the admiral protested, as their car passed through the outer gate and speeded into an inky void. "Can Russians see like cats?"
The car stopped in blackness. The escort guided the three Americans to a doorway. They passed inside and found themselves in the small, cold foyer of the Hotel National, where one dim lamp burned at the reception desk. The porter who had opened the door was muffled in a fur coat. The elevator stood open, dark, and abandoned. The admiral bade them good night and plodded to the staircase.
"Come up for a minute," Henry said to Leslie Sloat.
"No, thanks. I'll grope my way to my apartment. It's not far."
Pug insisted, and Sloat followed Henry up the gloomy staircase to his squalid little room on an areaway.
"I don't rate like Tudsbury," he said.
"Tudsbury's about the best propagandist the Soviet Union's got," Sloat said, "and I guess they know it."
Pug unlocked a suitcase, took a narrow dispatch case out, unlocked that, and glanced through papers.
"I hope you understand," Sloat said, "that those locks are meaningless. All the contents of that case have been photographed."
"Yes," Victor Henry said absently.
He slipped a letter into his pocket.
"Would you like a snooze? Please stick around for a while. Something may be doing."
"Oh?" Out of his new and growing respect for Henry, Sloat asked no questions, but stretched out on the hard, narrow bed to a twang and squeak of springs. His head still reeled from the champagne that shadowy attendants had kept pouring at the movie. Next thing he knew, knocking woke him. Victor Henry was talking at the door to a man in a black leather coat.
"Хорошо, ми готови," he said in his atrocious accent. "Одну минуту."
He closed the door.
"Want to wash up or anything, Leslie? I'd like you to come with me."
"Where to?"
"Back to the Kremlin. I have a letter from Harry Hopkins for the big cheese. I didn't think I was going to get to hand it over in person, but maybe I am."
"Good Lord, does the ambassador know about this?"
"Yes. Admiral Stanley brought him a note about it from the president. I gather he was annoyed, but he knows."
Sloat sat up.
"Annoyed? I should think so. Mr. Hopkins has a way of doing these things. This is very outlandish, Captain Henry. Nobody should ever, ever see a head of state without going directly through the ambassador. How have you arranged this?"
Me? I had nothing to do with it. I'm an errand boy. Hopkins wanted this letter to go to Stalin informally and privately, or not at all. In my place, you don't argue with Harry Hopkins. I understand he talked to Omansky. If it puts you in a false position, I guess I'll go alone. There'll be an interpreter. Calculating the angles in this astonishing business, mainly the angle of his own professional self-preservation, Sloat began combing his hair at a yellowed wall mirror. I'll have to file a written report with the ambassador. Sure. In a long, high-ceilinged, bleakly lit room lined with wall maps, Stalin sat at one end of a polished conference table, with many papers piled on a strip of green cloth before him. A stone ashtray at the dictator's elbow brimmed with cigarette butts, suggesting that he had been steadily at work since the departure of the banquet guests. He now wore a rough khaki uniform which sagged and bulged, and he looked very weary. Pavlov, his usual English interpreter, sat beside him, a thin, pale, dark-haired young man with a clever, anxiously servile expression. There was nobody else in the big room. As the uniformed protocol officer ushered in the two Americans, Stalin rose, shook hands, with a silent, gracious gesture waved them to chairs, and then sat down, with an inquiring look at Captain Henry. Henry handed him the letter and a round box wrapped in shiny blue paper. "Mr. Chairman, I'd better not inflict my bad Russian on you any longer," he said in English, as Stalin carefully opened the White House envelope with a paper knife. Sloat translated, and Stalin replied in Russian, slightly inclining his head. "As you wish." He passed to Pavlov the single handwritten pale green sheet, on which the White House was printed in an upper corner. Pug said, as Stalin unwrapped the box, "And that is the special Virginia pipe tobacco Mr. Hopkins told you about, that his son likes so much." Pavlov translated this, and everything the American captain said thereafter, sometimes conveying Henry's tone as well as a quick, exact version of his words. Sloat sat silent, nodding from time to time. Stalin turned the round blue tin in his hands.
"Mr. Hopkins is very thoughtful to remember our casual chat about pipe tobacco. Of course, we have plenty of good pipe tobacco in the Soviet Union."
He twisted open the tin with a quick wrench of strong hands and curiously inspected the heavy lead foil seal before slashing it with a polished thumbnail and pulling a pipe from his pocket.
"Now you can tell Mr. Hopkins that I tried his son's tobacco."
Pug understood Stalin's Russian in this small talk, but he could not follow him after that. Stalin stuffed the pipe, put a thick wooden match to it, and puffed fragrant blue smoke, while Pavlov translated Hopkins' letter aloud. After a meditative silence, the dictator turned veiled, cold eyes on Victor Henry and proceeded to speak, pausing to let Pavlov catch up in English after three or four sentences.
"That is a strange letter from Mr. Hopkins. We all know the United States manufactures millions of automobiles per year of many different models and types, including big, luxurious, complicated machines such as Cadillacs and so forth. What is the problem with landing craft, then? Landing craft are armored lighters with small, simple engines. Surely you can produce as many as you want to. Surely the British have plenty already. I cannot see this as a real obstacle to a second front in Europe now, as Mr. Hopkins states."
Pug Henry pulled from his dispatch case sketches and production tables of landing craft. "Different types must be designed from scratch and manufactured, Mr. Chairman, to land against a solidly fortified coast. We expect mass production in mid-1942, at the latest. These papers may be of interest." Unexpectedly, in mid-translation,
Stalin uttered a short, harsh laugh and began to talk fast in Russian, straight at Victor Henry. Sloat and Pavlov made quick notes, and when the dictator paused, Pavlov took over and spoke with much of Stalin's hard, sarcastic tone.
"That is very fine, mid-1942. Unfortunately, this is October 1941. If Mr. Hitler would only halt operations until mid-1942. But perhaps we cannot count on that. And what will happen meantime? I regard Mr. Harry Hopkins."
Stalin said, "Gospodin Gary Gopkins. As a friend and a clever man, doesn't he know that any operation that the British can mount now, just a reconnaissance in force of a few divisions, if they can do no better, might decide the course of this war? The Germans have only very weak reserves, mere token forces on the French coast. They are throwing everything into the battle on our front. Any action in the west might make them pause and draw off just the decisive margin of strength here."
Stalin doodled in red ink on a gray, unlined pad during the interpretation, drawing a wolf.
Victor Henry said, "Mr. Chairman, I am instructed to answer any questions about the landing craft problem."
Stalin used the back of his hand to shove aside the papers Pug Henry had laid before him.
"Landing craft? But it is a question of will, not of landing craft. However, we will study the matter of landing craft. Of course, we have such machines, too, for landing on defended coasts. Perhaps we can lend-lease some to the British. In 1915, when war equipment was more primitive than today, Mr. Churchill managed to put a big force ashore in Gallipoli, thousands of miles from England. Possibly he found the experience discouraging. But the Japanese have, in recent years, put ashore more than 1 million soldiers in China. Those men surely did not swim across in such cold waters. So it is obviously a question of will, not of landing craft. I hope Mr. Harry Hopkins will use his great influence to establish a second front now in Europe, because the outcome of the war against the Hitlerites may turn on that. I can say no more."
The dictator finished the wolf in rapid strokes during the translation and started another with bared fangs and a hanging tongue. He looked up at Henry with the oddly genial expression common in his photographs and changed his tone.
"Have you enjoyed your stay? Is there anything we can do for you?"
Victor Henry said, "Mr. Chairman, I have been a wartime military observer in Germany and in England. Mr. Hopkins asked me to go to the front here, if an opportunity arose, so as to bring him an eyewitness report."
At the word front, Stalin shook his head.
"No, no, we are obliged to guarantee the safety of our guests. That we cannot do in the present stage of fighting. Mr. Hopkins would not forgive us if some misfortune befell you."
"Mr. Hopkins has been unsparing of his own health, sir. It is wartime."
An opaque, wild look, almost the look in a gorilla's eyes, came into Stalin's gaze.
"Well, you should understand that things are bad at the front. The Germans are breaking through again in force. We may soon see the worst hours for Russia since 1812. You will hear all the news tomorrow. That is why a second front now would earn for England the friendship of my people until the end of time."
He went back to work on the wolf. Pug said soberly,
"In view of this news, Mr. Chairman, I admire your cheerfulness of spirit at the banquet tonight."
Stalin shrugged his broad, sagging shoulders.
"Wars are not won by gloom, nor by bad hospitality. Well, if Mr. Hopkins wants you at the front, he must have good reasons. We will see what we can do. give him my thanks for the letter and the tobacco. It is not bad tobacco, though I am used to my Russian tobacco. Please tell him my feelings about the Second Front. Perhaps your trip to our front could bring home the urgency. Mr. Hopkins is a good adviser to your great president, and as you are an emissary from him, I wish you well. Leaving the Kremlin and driving through the blackout, the two Americans said not a word. When the car stopped, Pug Henry spoke.
Well, I'll talk to you tomorrow. I guess these fellows will take you home.
No, I'll get out.
On the sidewalk, Sloat touched Pug's arm as the limousine drove off.
Let's talk here. I was utterly shocked by this business of going to the front. If Mr. Hopkins knew of the catastrophic situation Stalin just admitted to... The diplomat's voice wavered, and he cleared his throat. He would surely withdraw those instructions.
The night was ending, and though the icy street was still black, Pug could just see Sloat's pale face under his fur hat.
I don't agree with you on that. He's a pretty tough customer, Hopkins.
Sloat persisted. You won't really get to the front, you know. They've just given some correspondents a tour. They kept them far behind the lines, feeding them caviar, quails, and champagne. Still, the Luftwaffe pulled an air raid on a village and almost nailed them.
Right, but that could happen to us here in Moscow, too.
But why go, for God's sake?
Sloat broke out in a ragged, shrill tone. He lowered his voice.
At best you'll see one tiny sector for a few hours. It's foolhardy sightseeing. It'll create endless trouble at the embassy, as well as for the Russians.
Victor Henry chain-lit a cigarette.
Listen. If you can watch 10 men under fire, you'll learn a lot about an army's morale in a few hours. Mr. Hopkins likes to call himself a glorified messenger boy. That's an exaggeration. But I'm an unglorified one. Doing this job might give me the illusion that I'm earning my salary. Come upstairs for a nightcap. I have some good scotch.
No, thank you. I'm going to write my report and then try to get an hour's sleep.
Well, cheer up. My own impression was that the big cheese was being affable, but that I won't get to go.
That's what I hope. No foreign military attaché has yet gone to the front or near it.
Good morning. During the talk, the sky had turned violet, and Sloat could see his way on the dead, quiet streets. This was a relief, for he had more than once banged into lampposts and fallen off curbs in the Moscow blackout. He had also been challenged at pistol point by patrolmen. One walked toward him now in the gray dawn and gave him a suspicious squint, then passed on without a word. In his flat, Sloat brewed coffee on the gas ring and rapidly typed a long account of the banquet and the meeting with Stalin. When he had finished, he threw back the blackout curtains. The sun was shining. Staggering, bleary, he took a loose-leaf diary from a drawer and wrote briefly in it, ending with these words. But the official report which I've just rattled off describes the meeting with Stalin in sufficient detail, and I'll keep a copy in my files. As for the Henrys, father and son, the puzzle is simply enough resolved after all. I saw the answer in the past few hours. They both have an instinct for action, and the presence of mind that goes with it. Byron displayed these traits in moments of physical danger. His father probably would, too. But I've just seen him act in more sophisticated and subtle situations, requiring quick thinking, hardihood, and tact. It is not easy to keep one's head in confronting a personage like Stalin, who has an aura like a large lump of radium, powerful, invisible, and poisonous. Victor Henry managed. On reflection, I can understand why the ladies like such men. The man of action protects, feeds, and presumably fecundates, QED, more vigorously and reliably than the man of thought. Possibly one can't change one's nature. Still, one can perhaps learn and grow. Captain Henry suggested that I disregard orders and expose the Minsk documents to Fred Fearing or some newspaper man. Such an act goes entirely against my grain, and entirely for that reason, I intend to do it. Chapter 53 Talky Tudsbury was having 5 o'clock tea alone in his hotel suite that day, with some light refreshment of sprats, cheese, sturgeon, black bread, and honey cakes, when Victor Henry came in and told him that he was going to the front. The correspondent got so excited that he stopped eating.
"Good God, man, you are! With the Germans swarming in all over the place, it's impossible. It's just talk. Dear Christ, these Russians are good at putting you off with talk. You'll never go."
He brushed up his mustaches and reached for more food.
"Well, maybe," Pug said, sinking into a chair and laying on his lap the briefcase stuffed with codes and harbor charts, which he had just collected at the Navy Ministry. He had had 5 or 6 hours broken sleep in 4 days. The room was jerking back and forth in his vision as he strove to stay awake. "But my clearance has just come in from pretty high up." Tudsbury was putting a chunk of bread heaped with sardines to his mouth. The morsel stopped in midair. He peered at Henry through his bottle-glass spectacles and spoke in low, quiet tones.
"I'll go with you."
"The hell you will."
"Victor, the correspondents went to the Central Front 2 weeks ago, when the Russians were counterattacking. The day they left, I had flu, with a sizzling temperature."
Tudsbury threw down the food, seized his cane, limped rapidly across the room, and began to put on a fur-lined coat and a fur hat.
"Who's handling this? Lozovsky? Can't I just tell him you said I could come? I know them all, and they love me. It's up to you."
Victor Henry did not want Tudsbury along, but he was exhausted, and he was sure the Russians would refuse.
"Okay."
"God bless you, dear fellow. Stay and finish my tea. Tell Pam I'll be back before 6, and she's to retype my broadcast."
"Where is she?"
"A letter came for her in the Foreign Office pouch. She went to get it."
Pug fell asleep in the armchair where he sat. Cold fingers brushing his cheek woke him.
"Hello there. Wouldn't you rather lie down?"
Pam stood over him, her face rosy from the frost, her eyes shining, wisps of brown hair showing under her gray lambskin hat.
"What? Oh!"
He blinked and stretched.
"What am I doing here? I guess I walked in and collapsed."
"Where's Talky?"
She was taking off her hat and gloves. "Why did he leave his tea? That's not like him." Sleep cleared from his brain like fog. He remembered his conversation with Tudsbury and told her. His face went stiff and strained.
"The front? They'll never let him go. But you? Victor, are you serious? Have you heard the BBC or the Swedish radio?"
"Yes."
"Well, I know better than to argue, but I can tell you this. Our embassy's getting ready to be moved to the Urals or somewhere. By the by, Ted's all right."
She went to the desk, still in her fur coat, and picked up typed yellow sheets.
"Oh, drat, another revision. Such niggling."
By now, Pug was used to her casual bombshells, but she dropped this one so swiftly that he wasn't sure he had heard her aright.
"Pamela, what's this? What about Ted?"
"He's fine. Or safe, anyhow."
"But where is he?"
"Oh, back in Blighty. Hardly the worse for wear, according to him. It seems he finally managed to escape, he and 4 French aviators, from a prison camp outside Strasbourg. He did have quite a few adventures in France and Belgium, straight out of the films, but he made it. I rather thought he would, sooner or later."
She sat down and took the cover off the typewriter.
Good God, girl, that's tremendous news.
Yes, isn't it? You must read his letter. 7 pages, written on both sides, and quite amusing. He's lost 3 stone, and he still has a bullet in his thigh, or, more accurately, in his behind. He's quite chastened. He'll take the desk job now, as soon as he can sit at a desk, he adds rather ruefully. And that means I'm to come straight home, and marry him, of course.
Pamela broke her offhand manner with a long glance at Victor Henry. She put on black-rimmed glasses.
I'd better get at this. And you obviously need some sleep.
No use. The mission's leaving soon. I have to see them off.
Pam, that's splendid about Ted. I'm very glad and relieved. Rubbing her hands and blowing on them, she said,
Lord, it would be a relief at that, wouldn't it? I mean to get away from Talkie's handwriting and his optimistic drivel.
Tudsbury burst in on them a little later, his face aflame, his nose empurpled by the cold, just as Henry was putting on his bridge coat.
Mojit bit! Qualified! Yes, by God! They'll confirm it tomorrow. But, Victor, I believe I'm going with you. Pam, have you finished yet? It's getting near that time. The Narcomindle's in mad confusion, Victor. The news from the front must be really bad. But, God Almighty, that clearance you've got, whatever it is, certainly is the secret password. Of course, they adore me, and they know I'm entitled to a trip, but the look that came over Lazovsky's face when I said you insisted that I accompany you.
Oh, Talkie. Pamela stopped typing and glared at him. Victor didn't insist at all. He couldn't have.
Pam, one has to bludgeon these people.
Tudsbury's face creased in a tricky grin.
I said you two were old friends, in fact, and that Victor rather liked you and wanted to oblige me. So please, back my story if occasion arises.
You unscrupulous old horror, Pamela said, her face mantling pink.
Well, that's true enough, as far as it goes, Victor Henry said. And I have to get on to the airport now. Pamela's got some great news, Talkie.
The intrusion of Tudsbury snagged the trip. The Narcomindel, the Foreign Office, hemmed, hawed, and stalled. Days went by. Pug remained in Moscow with nothing to do. The ambassador and the attachés acted cool and distant, for Victor Henry was that plague of the Foreign Service, an interloper from Washington. Once he dropped in on Sloat's office and found the diplomat pale, harassed, and given to pointless giggling.
"Say, what's my daughter-in-law doing on your desk?" Pug said.
Natalie smiled from a silver frame, looking younger and fatter, with her hair in an unbecoming knot.
"Oh, yes, that's Natalie," Sloat laughed. "Do you suppose Byron would mind? She gave it to me ages ago, and I'm still fond of her. What's happened to your trip? You won't have far to go, at the rate the Germans are coming on, hee-hee."
"God knows," Pug said, thinking that this man was in bad shape. "Maybe it's all off."
The main trouble, it turned out, was Pamela. Her father had asked to bring her along, claiming helplessness without her. He had since withdrawn the request, but the Narcomindel had fed the 3 names into the great obscure machine that handled the matter, and there was no starting over. Lazovsky began to lose his genial humor when Pug appeared or telephoned.
"My dear Captain, you will hear when you will hear. There are other equally pressing problems in the Soviet Union just now."
So Pug wandered the streets, observing the changes in Moscow. New red and black posters blazed appeals for volunteers in the crude, bold socialist imagery of muscular young workmen and peasant women brandishing bayonets at spiders, snakes, or hyenas with Hitler faces. Labor battalions, shouldering spades and picks, marched raggedly here and there. Big trucks, crammed with children, crisscrossed the city. Long queues stood at food shops, despite the heavy rain that persisted day after day. Soldiers and horse-drawn carts vanished from the streets. Under the sodden caps and wet shawls of street crowds, the swarm of white, high-cheekboned faces wore a different look. The Slavic phlegm was giving away to knotted brows, inquiring glances, and a hurrying pace. Victor Henry thought that the approach of the Germans made the Muscovites look more like New Yorkers. Lazovsky finally telephoned him at the hotel, his voice ringing cheerily.
"Well, Captain, will tomorrow at dawn suit you? Kindly come here to the Narkomindel, wear warm clothing, a raincoat, and good boots, and be prepared to be out 3 or 4 days."
"Right. Is the girl coming too?"
"Of course."
The Russian sounded surprised and a bit offended.
"That was the problem. Really, it was not easy to clear, though we wanted to make the exact arrangements you desired. Our Russian girls face combat conditions as a matter of course, but we know that foreign ladies are much less hardy. Still, we all know Miss Tudsbury. She is attractive, and one understands such a devoted friendship. It is arranged."
Victor Henry decided to ignore the jollying, even ribald tone, and not to try to rewrite this record. "I'm grateful, and I'll be there." They drove southward from Moscow in the rain, and all morning ground along in a thunderous parade of army trucks, stopping only for a visit to